2024 is coming to an end, and what a year it has been in every way. It has been a, I don't know, maybe also a good year for some of our listeners, but on the global scale, I think maybe a difficult one or an interesting one, to say the least. My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Balder Hagritz, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast. Balder, how are you doing in these last few days of 2024? Are you one of those people who kind of looks back and has these review moments saying, oh, crazy. Oh, what happened here? What happened there?
Well, hi, Dario. It feels more that my life is kind of the final days of Western civilization. And I'm just throughout my life reviewing the end of our Western culture. In some ways, I'm like an example of everything that's wrong with this world, because my life is really nice. My life is great. It's just that the world around us is burning and human suffering and destruction are skyrocketing, and there doesn't seem to be a clear solution in sight. So this might be a slightly depressing end of year episode, Dario, but it is what it is.
Because I am one of those people who looks back, usually in the last few years, right after Christmas, before New Year's, I have this moment when I try to remember what happened each month. But this year, so many things happened that when I was asked this question at work a few days ago, when they were like, so how did you like this year? Did you feel good about it? What would you like to improve for the next year? I had to think back, and I had real difficulties identifying what February was. So I mixed it up a little bit, where suddenly I brought up things from February 2023. Then I threw in things that happened this year in July, which I was convinced happened in February. It's that just a lot of things have been happening. What I kind of said a few episodes ago, that we are currently experiencing a quarterly politics or foreign policy crisis every 2 or 3 days.
Yeah. That's absolutely true. It's been a very full year in that sense. And it's not that we ever ran out of topics, but this year we've had way too many topics that we couldn't cover, because there's just, like you said, always something to talk about. And that's not necessarily a good thing, right? Fukuyama and others in the 1990s promised us that 21st century was going to be boring, basically the end of history. Well, it turns out that the 21st century is very interesting, and that's not a good sign. Any particular things that you observed when you started reviewing the year?
As I said, that I don't remember what happened in February. I could not tell you right now what major event in foreign policy, in politics, or in general took place in February. I really could not. The furthest thing I can think back right now is that at some point Israel started invading Lebanon. And that already feels like it was months ago, but no, it just happened in September, October. Yeah. So that's, I think that summarizes my year very well, is that I cannot remember what happened in February.
There's also a real danger in that, right, that because there's so much happening, is that as a self-defense mechanism, our brain starts numbing itself and starts kind of forgetting about things. You become so used to things that at some point it no longer is surprising, and at some point you no longer try to do something about it. This is one of the things that you can notice in terms of, for example, xenophobia, that you often can notice with dark undercurrents in society, that if they become so frequent, at some point you just stop caring, and that is when they win, right? When the darkness wins.
Do you know one topic I've become really numb about? That's the war in Ukraine. I could not tell you what happened this year. I mean, Zelensky was in Berlin a few times, right? I know this because that's the moment when my commute to work becomes interrupted. But that's about as much as I've thought about this topic, is that it's really just this. It's now the third year of the war. And it really seems to be World War One all over again, that there are trenches and people are shooting at each other.
Yeah, and that is typical, I think, of generally Western attitudes towards Ukraine. The hype is definitely long gone. Now, it's also true that it got replaced partially by Israel, of course. In that sense, you know, at some point, the hype just needs to make way for other things. But it is very clear that in the West right now, people don't really like thinking about Ukraine anymore. It no longer seems that relevant. It's still a daily relevant to those in Ukraine, obviously, because they're fighting for the survival of their country still. But there's also a factual observation about simply that not much on the battlefield has changed compared to December 2023. Russia has made minor territorial gains. There's been nothing spectacular for the media to report, except a slow downward decline of Ukraine's chances of success, or at least chances of minimizing failure, right? Slowly over time, and certainly in 2024, that's become completely obvious, Ukraine is losing ground, is losing steam, and Russia has consolidated. And then from a Western perspective, that means that a lot of people no longer want to think about it because it's no fun to be on the loser side. You want to be on the winner side. You want to feel that you are victorious in history. Otherwise, there's no enjoyment there, right? And so the West is likely going to ignore Ukraine even more, certainly now with Donald Trump coming in. And that is a real problem for Ukraine because they're not doing well. They haven't been doing well for quite some time. And at some point, this needs to come to an end. And Zelensky obviously knows this. The Ukrainian government knows this. And this is why they've started this diplomatic offensive and why they're going to try to give Trump a win by having some kind of summit where some kind of ceasefire and maybe even peace deal can be brokered.
That would be ideal from a humanitarian perspective, right? I mean, we've been saying this in many episodes in the past, that ultimately, when we look at it, particularly on a Christmas, right, from a Christmas perspective, there is a lot of families in Ukraine right now that are very sad and upset because either they can't be together, their husbands or sons are fighting, or maybe they have fallen. And the exact same thing is happening on the Russian side, right? Where there's a lot of Russian families that will also not be celebrating Christmas together because of the realistic foreign policy reality on the ground, is that there is war happening and people are dying every day.
Indeed, and as Western media has been almost gloating about, which is kind of disturbing, we can add to those countries now North Korea. North Korea are losing soldiers on the front in quite large numbers, apparently. Yeah, so that is an absolute truth that the violence is now continuing without any clear sign of success. So if the violence stops, that's good news in that regard. It also emphasizes the point that history is unjust, right? And we find that very difficult typically to accept. But throughout history, populations, countries have unjustly suffered and have lost the good fight in many ways. And that is visible with Ukraine right now. Ukraine is going to have to make compromises that have nothing to do with justice, that have nothing to do with the international system, nothing to do with how we want the world to be organized. But it is what it is. It's the only way to consolidate and to stop more people from dying and more destruction to take place. And the same could be said for the Palestinian people. There's nothing just about the Palestinians over the past year or over the past 70 years, about the way that they've been treated by the international community, by Israel. But here we are. And at some point, we need to move on from that injustice.
I have a little quiz. Because I just tried to recall this. Walter, do you, like, if you had to say a month during which the North Korean soldiers were sent to Russia and then into Ukraine, which month of the year did this happen in?
Oh, that's a good question. Let me think. I don't know the answer, but let me guess that this was in August.
In August, right? I mean, I would have said July. No, it happened in October.
Oh, wow.
It happened just 2 months ago.
Yeah.
It was late October. So, I think it's a great example of how much has been happening in the year. You've already brought up Gaza and Israel with this. I mean, and that's the next topic that I kind of want to talk about when reviewing this year. It's so much has happened, right? I do not recall when kind of the point or like the favor on Israel shifted within the West, right? Because I still remember at the beginning of 2024, everyone was still very much with Israel, saying that, yes, you have the right to defend yourself. Please be careful with all the civilians in Gaza. But you are in your, you know, we are with you. And that has definitely changed within, I would say, the general Western attitude, not necessarily within Western policymakers. I think we have to differentiate between that. But at some point, Israel has definitely lost the plot.
Yeah. To be honest, they already quite quickly lost the plot. It's just that it took a while for Western media to start reporting on that, right? What is particularly disturbing is that after losing the plot, they lost the plot a little bit more and even a little bit more. And they went completely disconnected from reality. And that's what you see even now as we're speaking, that they're bombing Yemen. And, you know, they basically, Israel is has become, or the Israeli government, I should say, has become this unbound loon running around the region and wreaking havoc on people around them, but also on themselves, right? I mean, it's very clear. The West, in that sense, look, there were critical voices already in October last year, 2023, November 2023, I would say that I critically analyzed Israel at university, and other professors did around the world. Some media reports wrote about it, but you're absolutely right that it took a long time for media and for the general population to sort of make that switch, right? And that is because we are, in the West, deeply connected with Israel, and we are also deeply antagonistic to anything that seems like terrorism. And therefore, the starting point was very, very favorable for Israel. And they had a huge buffer before the general population in Western countries started actually taking notice. However, now in December 2024, it's completely obvious to anyone with any reasonable perspective on this conflict, on the violence, that Israel is responsible for enormously unnecessary destruction.
Enormously unnecessary destruction. I think that's a very good way to put it. And that has not only happened in Gaza, but as I mentioned a few minutes ago, it also happened in Lebanon. Now the Syrian army has kind of taken the opportunity and has also advanced a few kilometers into Syria. As you said, they're bombing in Yemen. They're very active, and it seems like while our kind of, I don't want to call this a prediction, but kind of us foreseeing the next steps in Ukraine, it seemed like de-escalation, and there will be some form of a diplomatic solution also because of what obviously the United States and Donald Trump have said about the matter. But it honestly doesn't seem like the Middle East will calm down in 2025, and the kind of right unchained Israel is going to act further and not necessarily be constrained by the United States under a Donald Trump administration.
No, again, there might be a, there is a scenario that is similar to the Ukrainian scenario where Israel could make the case that because there's a new American administration and because they trust the Trump administration, they want to now have some kind of summit and bring operations to a halt, right? It might be an escape route for Netanyahu, because otherwise the problem is, when does Israel now stop? They've already gone so deep down the rabbit hole. When do they say, hey, we are done with the violence around us? We are done with bombing countries that we don't like, right? The aggressive nature of their military actions in Syria and the announcements by Netanyahu and others about the Golan Heights, for example, show that they have gone down a route that no longer can be rationally turned back on. It's basically, we are going to take the right into our own hands to destroy anyone who we believe might in the future be a risk to our country, which is not how international relations works, right? That's the whole point of this failure. Yes, there might be a risk. The Soviet Union and the United States during the Cold War were the biggest existential risk that you can imagine towards each other. But it didn't mean that one of them could preemptively start striking the other, exactly because you want to avoid disaster. Israel seems to have lost that message, and it's going to be extremely hard for them to now make the case that they are done and it's been a success. And that means that they're likely going to continue until at some point some kind of political revolt takes place in Israel itself.
And we have, as with Ukraine, I think not as much yet, because it's also the conflict is a bit younger, or at least the recent escalation of violence is a bit younger. But I do think that we have become more numb to the topic in 2024. I mean, certainly, I don't know, I personally feel that, where also because there's so many different battlegrounds right now, it's very difficult to just pay attention to what's happening in Gaza, and then you look at, oh, what's happening in Lebanon, in Yemen, and then in Syria. It does seem like we are more numb to it. Western attention is more numb to it. And as you mentioned, already constrained by how much we like Israel to begin with. I also do not see any positivity in that topic, which is very, very frustrating. I mean, maybe, who knows? I'm hearing a lot of activities already going on within the Trump team, that Trump has, right, he has his chip on his shoulder with the Abraham Accords, and that he wants to basically be the big peacemaker towards the Middle East. And he's really pushing for normalization between Israel and Saudi Arabia. And that, at least according to the Saudis, will only happen with a Palestinian state. You know, maybe we all have to apologize to the Donald afterwards and say, hey, you brought peace to the Middle East, and because of you, there's a Palestinian state now.
Well, that first thing that you said about Trump, that's kind of what I referred to before. That could be the way out for Israel, where they basically give Trump this win, and it would be for them a way to cover themselves and say, yeah, well, we brought the violence to an end because we believe now that a new president, a U.S. president, can actually guarantee our safety and our rights and that kind of thing. And that's connection with Saudi Arabia is, of course, a connection that has already existed under the Biden administration, and we discussed it in previous episodes. So that is absolutely a scenario. That is a possible scenario. The second bit about we have to apologize to Trump later and all that, that's, of course, a bit of nonsense in the sense, I mean, not what you said, but this belief that there is that Trump will actually bring peace to the Middle East, in the sense that there is no Palestinian state to be built up anymore. What are you talking about, a Palestinian state? You know, what kind of Palestinian state? Where would that be? In completely destroyed Gaza? In fragmented West Bank? Where? What are we talking about? So, yes, there might be a peace process. That peace process will be essentially a normalization of ties between Saudi Arabia and Israel. The Palestinians will be then used, as they so often have, as sort of some kind of bargaining chip, so that Saudi Arabia can find cover, because Saudi Arabia just wants to normalize relations. And if they can say, we've done this by supporting the Palestinian cause, great, but the Palestinians themselves don't really matter that much to Riyadh. And so the Palestinians will then be given some land back, or will be given some, I don't know, a $10 billion fund to rebuild all the destruction. That will not in any way solve the problem. That there is no way that the actual underlying human suffering and potential for future violence will disappear because of some peace process that looks good for Riyadh and for Donald Trump.
I'm trying to find a good transition from Ukraine, like the war in Ukraine, the war in Gaza, to the next kind of big topic that we want to look at for 2024, the big trend. I'm going to attempt it by saying, going from the Saudi billionaires to Western billionaires, I still find comfort in the fact that the Saudis are so much richer than any of the Western billionaires could ever imagine, but they don't need to brag about it, right? So in case Elon Musk ever feels like, oh, I'm the richest person here, I know that the Saudis could easily buy him up. So that sometimes gives me comfort, right? Just from that haha perspective. But moving over to billionaires, this was a good year for billionaires, right? They've become wealthier. They've made more billions. That's excellent, right? It means the economy must be going well. And I mean, we can all model after these billionaires. So a good year for the billionaires overall.
Yeah, it's been a very good year for billionaires in terms of their bank accounts and their investments. Like almost every year for the past 25 years, right? Even the years around the economic crisis weren't that bad for billionaires, which is exactly the problem. Because yes, GDP has been going up, as it typically does. There are only very few years that GDP doesn't grow. And what you see is that all of that growth, or almost all of that growth, goes to the top 10, top 1% of Western society. And that economic growth is not shared by the middle class, let alone by the working classes, which is why in a country like the United States, you see many groups within middle class standards of living not having actually seen an increase in their real wage for the past 25 years. Yes, an increase in terms of nominal wage increases because of inflation and because of purchasing power differences, but not in terms of actually becoming better off economically. The only groups that substantially are benefiting from the way that Western society works at the moment are the top 10 and especially the top 1%.
Well, to me, what this tells me is that there's a few people who are doing really well, so they must be doing something right. And I'm pretty sure that we as a society can learn a lot from them and that they should actually help us governing our societies, right? So, I mean, Elon Musk is so rich and he has so many companies, so I'm sure he must be doing something right. So let's invite him to government, Boulder, right? And that is another trend that we've been observing, that billionaires are having more and more political power. And so I do believe in the American dream and in the South African Musk dream that through his help, we can all be billionaires someday.
And this, ladies and gentlemen, is Dario Hasenstab's attempt at sarcasm. unfortunately, what you're just saying actually does exist, right? At least it exists on the internet, so there must be some people who actually think this. I don't believe in my own surroundings they are there, or maybe they try to hide from me. This is absolutely still an existing pattern, narrative, when it comes to talking about billionaires. Hey, they've worked hard for it. They are clearly intelligent. They provide value to society. Good for them. The idea that being a billionaire is a sign of how successful Western society can be. Whereas in reality, and this is something we have discussed in the past as well, the existence of billionaires is a negative consequence of our system. It is something that is difficult to avoid because capitalism kind of works in many ways. In a positive way, I mean, it has positive consequences, but having that billionaire class is actually a really negative externality to this and something that is not a sign of success. It's a sign of the weakness of society. There's nothing that says that if you work hard and that you're intelligent, that then automatically you become successful in society. There are loads of people who are very intelligent, work incredibly hard, who struggle every day, every month to get by. The existence of these billionaires has always been a problem. It's always something that is slightly off about society, but in 2024 and in the 21st century in general, this has gotten out of hand in the sense that they have become way richer than the rest of society. So the income disparity has grown enormously. And their influence on our system, on society, on politics, as you said, Elon Musk and other billionaires during the Trump administration, but also in European countries, has skyrocketed and has become a major, major problem for anyone who believes in the future of Western society, because this is not the way you want to run society.
And in 2024, this has also become accepted, is that, billionaires are very involved, they have a lot of money, therefore they have a lot of power. That's okay. You know, I mean, you kind of brought up, right in the preparation for this episode, you brought up the example of, let's say, Bill Gates joining the Clintons, the first Clinton administration. I mean, that's something where there was, for sure, there were exchanges and there was influence, but not as openly, and they certainly weren't super proud of it.
No, that's exactly it. So you would have someone like Bill Gates who always had political influence, spent money on elections, no doubt about it, had access to the White House, but it was kind of understood that it had to be done with a certain either modesty or at least relative invisibility. It couldn't be done in the open because people wouldn't accept it. And there would be regular articles, newspaper articles and conversations criticizing the access that the upper class had to politics. And now it seems like an accepted consensus that it's okay. And people don't really worry that much about it anymore. That is not to say that billionaires never tried to get into politics explicitly. I mean, in my days, this was in the 1990s, there was this candidate called Ross Perot, who was a billionaire, who ran basically with his own money and got something like, if I if I'm correct, 20% of the vote in the primaries or something like that. He had some success. But that was clearly a billionaire trying to buy himself into the White House. There was nothing hidden about that. But only recently, for the past few years, have we started accepting the fact that billionaires control major aspects of Western political dynamics. And that acceptance, that goes back to what you said before about numbness, right? It's kind of that we are getting so, we've heard it so often that at some point we just don't care anymore.
No, not particularly. I mean, to speak with the internet language, and I do apologize for my language now, but I have only a certain amount of fucks to give, yeah. Right? And some of them I need in my private life, right? And then maybe also my job. And then there's obviously politics. But this year I've already had to give a lot of that. And billionaires aren't very high up on my list. There's other things that have more intense consequences, particularly in the short term, right? War. But a billionaire buying themselves into politics, into the government, I know exactly how damaging that will be long term, but I also only have that much attention to spend, okay? I can't focus on everything.
No, and this is exactly the problem with a year and arguably longer than a year period, where so many things seem to be going wrong. People feel stressed. People have some things that are clearly more important than others. And it allows a space for slightly less obvious dynamics to occur, right? When we are all focused on Israel, or we're all focused on Ukraine, or we're all focused on COVID, at that moment, that is when other dynamics within society go unseen, until obviously at some point they manifest themselves in horrific ways. And by the way, anyone who's listening and says, hey, Baldur Dario, you just don't like Elon Musk and you've got this is some kind of bias against him. Well, think about it, assuming that you like Elon Musk and you think he's going to do well in the Trump administration. How would you feel about Bill Gates, who is very much liberal at least in his overt politics, actually joining the Biden administration and becoming a powerful figure within Biden? You would be outraged by that, right? So anyone, this is always a good test of bias. If it is just about a person, just about Elon Musk, well, okay, well, then that would be a personal chip on my shoulder. But the concept of billionaires in politics is a very scary concept, because it combines two aspects that should be separated, money and political power. And the more that becomes overtly the case, the more it should be a problem for anyone, regardless of whether you're right-wing, left-wing, whether you like Elon Musk or not.
I mean, at least I hope that I would be equally outraged about both of them. Again, I do have a slight bias against Elon Musk, just because I don't know, I listen to him sometimes and I read whatever he says, and there's a lot of, let's just say he should stick to business, right? He's done a relatively good job at Tesla and SpaceX and some of his other inventions. Why don't you focus on that and leave the government to people who actually know about government?
And indeed, yeah, no, and it's completely obvious from other episodes that I've got a real thing against Elon Musk's presence in the political and internet sphere as well. So that's there's that. I don't know if it's a bias, but I have a very clear dislike for his presence in these political conversations. Having said that, absolutely, I would be equally upset if any other billionaire did this to a democratic government.
Well, maybe there's a positive side to Elon Musk being in the government, because he believes in global warming. And global warming is kind of one of the other topics that that has prominently taken place in 2024, right? I mean, we have known about global warming for a long time, for many decades, but it's becoming more and more of a thing also in our day-to-day realities, right? So there was obviously the one in the flooding in Valencia just a few weeks ago, that I think is still very present on everyone's mind. Right now, there was that storm on Mayotte, right? That island, that French territory, call it what you want, where huge parts of the island were destroyed. And this is coming, at least these natural disasters are coming at an alarming rate lately.
And in some ways, this is exactly the same as what we just discussed, because it's been slowly building up towards it. And because for the past 20 years or so, we've been essentially told that it is time to panic about the climate, we are kind of numb to it. The first time that scientists took real issue with climate change was already way back in the 20th century, in the 60s, in the 70s. In 1975, there was the Club of Rome report. Since then, gradually, increasingly, we've been told by scientists, by the media, by some politicians, that there is a real problem. And now in 2024, we've heard it so often that our society is basically not reacting in any way that is reasonable, right? The reasonable reaction to this problem would be we need to drastically alter our way of life, drastically alter the way that we run this world, because otherwise our children and our grandchildren are going to be in real, real trouble. But instead, we like to close our ears and sing la 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 and pretend that it's not there. It kind of reminds me of that analogy, that kind of cliche analogy with the frog in the boiling water, right? Which isn't, by the way, true. Frogs don't do this. But the idea is that if you let a frog in a cup of water and slowly you boil the frog from 10 degrees to 100 degrees, that they will stay in because they won't notice the increasing temperature so gradually. Now, in reality, that's not true, but it's a nice analogy. Versus if you compare a frog being thrown into boiling water, they would immediately jump out, right? That is kind of what's happened with our society. Slowly over time, the temperature, the climate change has been boiling, and we just don't really feel that there's any moment where we have to radically alter the way we do things. And that's a real problem, because we absolutely need to stop behaving in the way that we are behaving, starting, by the way, with the billionaires. All those supposedly successful people with their private yachts and with their private planes and Taylor Swift flying around the world and those kinds of things, you know, just symbolically, that is enormously detrimental to this, because that's exactly the opposite of what we should be doing.
I'm a little bit concerned about the history of this frog experiment. I hope not too many frogs were harmed in this experiment.
I suspect that it's purely someone who thought that it sort of made sense and never actually tried it out. Because apparently some scientists have tried it out, hopefully only once or twice, and it doesn't work. The frog at some point absolutely jumps out when it gets too hot. So but it is a nice kind of visualization of the problem that we're facing, right? If all of a sudden, tomorrow, we hear aliens are about to arrive on Earth, we have to defend ourselves against an evil alien force, the whole world would be up in arms and we would all be radically changing the way we do behave, because we know that if we don't work together and solve this threat from outer space, we would die. But that is not how climate works. Climate goes gradually over time, and there's never that moment of panic where we say, now we have to go into crisis mode.
See, now I'm a little bit distracted from this episode as a whole, because I just imagined, you know, that scene from Independence Day where now it would be Donald Trump in a fighter jet fighting aliens. So how do we get back from this to the episode? I mean, Let's talk a bit more about climate change, because I do not want, right, so we have five topics for this episode, and I do not want climate change to be the one that we quickly brush over, because it is exactly, I don't know, it's exactly so every day. It's really scary what's happening all over the world, right? There's floodings, there's natural disasters, there's currently a lot of wildfires taking place, right? And we are not really talking about it. I mean, it's also Christmas, so that would really kill the mood.
I think we're killing the mood quite well with this episode, Dario. I hope people listen to this in January when they, you know, they're a little bit hungover and they can deal with it.
I do hope so too. I think the global media has a bit of a bigger reach than us, at least for now. But I'm not hearing anything about wildfires, but they're taking place. Places are burning, and it's obviously not helping any of the climate problem. So left, right, and center, there's so many of these catastrophes happening, and yet we are, right? So this is if to go back to the frog example, some of the bubbles are already coming up left and right, right? It's small ones, little ones, so you would think the frog would jump now. But if you look at the main topics of the German elections, right, that will be taking place soon, it is about, okay, the economy. We need to get the economy going under, at all costs, because we need to get the economy going.
Yeah, I don't have numbers on this, but anecdotally, I'm fairly confident to say that climate and climate change is politically less relevant today than it was 10 years ago. I mean, it's not less relevant to our existence and to human civilization, but it is clearly less on the agenda than it used to be in the past decade.
Oh, no, I do have the numbers for this, because for my job, I just looked at this, right, where in 2019... it must have been one of the better years in the past, right? So 2019, you had the parliamentary elections, right? The European Parliament elections. And that was also the high point of Fridays for Future. And so across the board, basically, amongst all demographics, it was said that climate change is the most important issue. And that's what we will vote based on. And that's what everyone voted on. Well, then a pandemic rolled around, right? And then there was a war in Ukraine and all these other things happening, and it has now been bumped thoroughly down. I mean, there was just a big, right, one of those representative studies that they did, where the youth in the West now, at least in Europe, one of their primary concerns is war, is that they're really concerned about war taking place in Europe, global warming is only on like the fourth or fifth position in kind of what's like in the concerns that young people have in particular, right? For them, it's war. It's also the state of the economy. It's will I have a job? It's retirement. Kids are thinking about retirement because we see it left, right and center that people do not have enough kind of to live off after they stop working. And only then the climate is coming. That's a huge change within these 5 years.
Yeah. And the war issue is fascinating, but also horrifying, because this comes because of the past 4 years, and certainly the past 2 years, we've been told that Russia is about to somehow strike after Ukraine, right? That somehow we have to be terrified of the Russian monster. And yet there is no serious scenario for war. I mean, if you live in Germany, or you live in the Netherlands, or you live in Spain, the chances of you in the next few decades experiencing war yourself are minimal. If that war does happen, it is a war that would have been started by our societies, by the West, by the $1.4 trillion NATO military machine. It's not as if China or Russia or any other country is about to invade. So the fact that people care about that rather than the climate shows the delusion that we're living in. It shows that there's something completely off about our perspective on the world and the reality of the world. There's a disconnect there. When it comes to climate change, I cannot emphasize enough how disturbing this is, that our media attention has drifted away to those other issues, because it is not a matter of a few billion more or less being spent on climate. It's going back to that alien analogy, right? Aliens are about to invade. Scientists tell us, hey, our satellites and our information tells us that aliens are going to be here in a month's time, and they are murderous, genocidal, they're about to kill us all. Then we're not going to have a conversation, oh, should we increase our military budget by 5%? No, we would radically alter the whole way that the world works to defend ourselves against those aliens. That is exactly what needs to happen with climate change. That's the only way that we can stop it. And yet, the conversation, if it is there, is about, oh, how many billions are we going to spend on it, rather than how do we radically alter society?
It would be such a typical human thing to do, right? So, aliens will reach the Earth within 5 years. They're coming with a lot of ships. They're coming our way. And Earth building up its military capacities. And then they arrive and it turns out, hey, you've been treating the planet really badly. Here's some advanced technology that you can save the planet with, right? Today is an interesting day.
Yeah, I apologize that in my analogy, I'm making the other the genocidal maniacs rather than us being the scary bits, right? But it was just to emphasize the issue with the climate. It's very unlikely that we will ever ever encounter aliens. The universe is too big for that. They might exist, but it's not likely that we will ever meet them. And I would hope that if we meet them, that they are a little bit more ethically and morally advanced than our society is.
One of my favorite scientists to listen to, Neil deGrasse Tyson, he always said that if aliens were to discover Earth and then kind of see what we do to each other, they would most likely conclude that this is not a place worth visiting. Why would we want to encounter those humans? If they do these terrible things to each other, just imagine what they will do to us. But Balder, it's a very right-wing populist thing of you to do, to kind of create an image of the other, and I want to rally up the troops. And that's my attempt of having another nice transition to our last topic, and that's the consolidation of the populist right as a political force within the West in 2024.
Yeah, I applaud your segues, Daya. This is very impressive. So, yes. So I've just joined the populist right in creating a nameless, invisible other that is about to kill us all. That's exactly what the Malonis and the Trumps and the Millets of this world also like doing. So let's talk about them. They have essentially become an accepted force in Western politics. Whereas before they were always seen as the uncomfortable outsider that we don't believe should be part of civil discourse, they have now become part of the mainstream. In fact, they are the mainstream, and those voices that 20 years ago would be mainstream are now seen as radical.
Very radical. I mean, there's countless articles that I have seen about Meloni, where she came into power. And obviously everyone is always super concerned. Someone is coming into power that we don't like and that we're really worried about. And then they come into power and suddenly everyone realizes, okay, you can kind of work with them. Like, they're not all bad. And then that's the moment they're being welcomed into the club, right? Where Meloni is now kind of celebrated in the European Union of, oh, she can work really well together with von der Leyen. Oh, she might be our person to talk to Donald Trump. That's actually great. Wow, that's amazing. And when it comes to Milei, right, the Argentinian president for the part of the listeners that might not know this, right, who is also somewhat radical in his approaches and was voted about a year ago, and has implemented some really radical economic measures, is now seeing some signs of success, right? Of short-term success, where inflation has gone down and other indicators that economists like are improving. And now there's discussions happening, oh, should we maybe do a bit of more, like, should we try to follow Milei in some of the policies? Is that maybe a possibility, right? So that populist right, kind of the crazy hair people, as I like to call them, they have become really normalized in our Western world.
Yes, and that process contains a few different variables. One is that our societies have become much more right-wing. Just statistically, it's completely obvious from the way that people view good policymaking. What do they want their governments to do? How do they vote? Western societies typically are much more right-wing in general than they were 25 years ago. And on top of that, they've become more populist because they also see that the world is not doing well. And when the world is not doing well, you turn to populism to vent your anger, to somehow believe that there is some kind of magic formula out there that populists can provide and that the establishment tries to block. You move in that direction. So that is about society in general, not about the leaders themselves. Now, one of the other issues that is problematic and that leads to what you just described, that the media at least is fearful of them, and then, hey, we turn in the other direction, is because they are initially painted as the devil himself, of themselves, right? Trump, in 2015, when it became clear that Trump was a candidate, 2016 got elected, 2017 became president, those early days, he was portrayed as if he was going to destroy the United States from inside out in those 4 years of presidency. And it turns out that that's not the case. He is a human being with much less power than we attribute to him, but also with no satanic rituals to perform on the United States. Just basically bad policymaking. And that doesn't seem that bad compared to what we were warned about. And that's the same with Meloni, and that's the same to a certain extent with Milei, that they turn out to be less extreme than the media warned about, And therefore, we then say, okay, it's not that bad. Let's deal with them normally. Even though their attitudes are far from normal about what kind of society they want to create.
One of the interesting observations, at least I had for me personally, about how populism behaved in 2024, is that the enemies were always within society, and we looked less and less at the enemies from outside of society. So I do remember Trump being a lot more adamant against China in his first election cycle, and that kind of it peaked in 2020 when he campaigned. But this time there was barely any mentioning. And I also do observe this in the European Union, that now it's a lot about looking inward, not looking out, like kind of to the outside world as much. And that allows China and India to kind of do their thing and kind of be unobserved by the West.
Yeah, and this is part of the populist playbook in many ways, right? You first create an invisible outside barbarian, an enemy that is about to destroy civilization. Then you build a power base, and then you say, oh, actually, the other side in our domestic politics are domestic enemies, the Democratic Party or the left-wing parties in Western Europe. They are actually some kind of sleeper cells on behalf of those scary outsiders. We have to start fighting them. And it becomes very much a us versus them. We are the good guys versus the other guys in our society or the bad guys. And as a result, the initial barbarian that was portrayed is no longer necessary. The outside enemy is no longer necessary at some point because it becomes about inside enemies. And that's exactly what you're seeing. Now, in itself, it's a good thing that Western society don't demonize China and don't demonize India, obviously. I mean, India and China should not be demonized. They're legitimate, powerful nations that have a lot of legitimacy in the eyes of many parts of the world. And as we have said over and over again in this podcast, are sometimes stereotyped in the West in ridiculous ways. As if there's nothing good that cannot come out of a country like China, as if there's something inherently evil about China. Well, newsflash, there isn't. What is interesting to analyze from a broader perspective is that despite China and India clearly growing in influence, clearly occupying that space that is left behind by the declining West, they are kind of uninspired. They're having issues at home. They're not, you know, yes, they're growing economically, and yes, they are doing well in international organizations, but their message doesn't resonate with the global population, right? It's not as if people in Europe or people in Sub-Saharan Africa or in Latin America go, wow, finally we're rid of the West. Now we can turn to the Chinese model or we can turn to the Indian model. Because they don't have that model either. The problems that the world is facing don't depend on any specific political model. And that's what you're seeing. So you see the shift in geopolitics and you see the West being very concerned about India, China, Russia becoming more and more powerful, but it's not a shift in terms of global ideology.
Now that we're at the end of this episode, and also at the end of a very negative episode, as I said, I don't think 2024 was necessarily a super good year for the world. Let's try to see if there's any positives. Valder, is there anything that makes you feel positive about 2025, given all these negative trends that we've identified?
Here again, you have to sort of differentiate between own personal lives and the globe in general. One thing that you can say and that we can analyze a bit is that out of these problems that we're facing and the fact that a lot of people are stressed and about these problems and starting to radicalize in terms of populism, is also the growth of a certain type of chaos. We are moving towards global anarchy in some ways, right? There's no longer any clear political ideology or clear movement that is controlling global dynamics. And even though anarchy and chaos themselves are not necessarily good, it can lead to new solutions. It can lead to the willingness to radically alter the way we've been doing things. Because let's face it, the existential problem of the world is not the failure of one COP conference about the environment, or it's not the failure of one invasion of Russia into Ukraine. I mean, that is enormously important to Ukraine, but from a global perspective, it's not what's going to decide the fate of humanity. What is the problem is long-term dynamics that remain unaddressed, and that chaos and anarchy might actually allow us to start addressing these situations.
I mean, I'm a big believer in that, that out of all chaos, like in every crisis, there's also a moment of opportunity, right? We can really change things around. And that's something that I'm basically clinging on to. And on the other hand, there's also a different trend that I've observed in 2024, and that's that there's a lot more conversations like this one happening. Is before, I felt like, well, everything was going well. There wasn't really a reason for anyone to kind of have a critical conversation. Are we heading the right direction? Are there some underlying problems that we are not facing, right? Maybe these were happening in the ivory towers in universities, but within the general population and the general conversation, I never observed these. That has changed, particularly this year, where I think things are going so bad that more and more people are saying, well, let's actually talk about this, right? And I think one of the examples also just happened a few weeks ago, right? Was, and we talked about this, was Luigi Mangione, can I call him kid? Yeah, he was very young, right? Like that young person, student, who murdered that CEO of that healthcare provider. And the conversations kind of resulting out of this are different, right? And it does, I mean, a lot of people are kind of inspired, like, yeah, revolution, right? And no, that's not what we want, right? But every one of these kind of crises and everyone, like every single moment like that, it seems like it's another stepping stone towards revolution, right? At least there's a bit of a conversation out there taking place right now that leads into that direction.
Yes, absolutely. The issue here, obviously, is that revolution itself, or murder, in the case of Luigi, is not positive, right? It's not there. I will find it very difficult to find an example of revolution in history where the outcomes were not destructive. There's always some destruction, and we shouldn't want that. But as we did mention in the previous episode, the fact that the internet is so supportive and almost like a whole fan base for Luigi, who is, if he gets convicted, he hasn't been convicted yet, but let's assume that he gets convicted, he is then a murderer. That the fact that so many people on the internet are happy to celebrate a murderer and send him money and lust after him and all those kinds of things says something about where we're heading. It's an anecdotal piece of evidence that is slowly becoming more common, where society is getting fed up with the way the things are working, is fed up with that billionaire class that we just discussed. And what surprises me about it is that the billionaire class, that upper class, that 1%, that top 10% perhaps, isn't actually saying, hang on, this is really, really bad. We need to actually change our lifestyle to only a certain extent so that we avoid that revolution, that we avoid the pitchforks throwing us out of our palaces, right? It is such an obvious moment that if I were a billionaire, if I had 100 billion in my investments, that I would say, okay, you know what? I'm going to start a whole program with lots of marketing and propaganda where I'm going to give away 50 billion to the poor in my society because I want to show that I am grateful for society and that I'm a productive influence in society. But that's not what the billionaire class is doing. Instead, they're pretending that it doesn't exist and they give a bit of charity here and there, but that's about it. They're pretending that the Luigis of this world are not a canary in the coal mine, if you like, for things to come. And they just continue to celebrate with their private yachts and their, you know, their private airplanes as if tomorrow will not come. And that to me is an astounding sign of the frailty of the human condition, right? That again, just like the environment, just closing your ears and going, la, 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 I can't see this happening. You know, it's fascinating, but it's also horrifying. If you're a billionaire and you happen to be listening to this podcast and you want to keep your opulence and your wealth for you and your children and grandchildren, for heaven's sake, start radically altering your external behavior and give half of your wealth away. You will still have 50 billion, congratulations. Give half of your wealth away, and that is a way for you to create safety for yourself and future generations.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on the year 2024. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them into our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next year when we burst the Western Bubble. That's it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us this year?
This quote at the end of the year is probably the shortest quote I've ever used for this podcast, but it's fitting both for the end of year episode as well as the end of Western civilization, as we have been discussing for quite a while. And it is by Seneca, the famous Roman philosopher, who said, "Whatever begins also ends."